You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 30th, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hi, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, everyone.
Rebecca, welcome back from TAM 5.5. We missed you last
week. Thank you. Oh, yeah. I missed you guys, too. You should have been there.
I wish we could have been down there. Here was a blast.
Really wanted to go.
It was a blast. It was such a blast that it's been 3 days since I've been back, and I'm still recovering. I don't even know if I'll be able to make it through this show, but I'm going to try.
You'll soldier on.
Yeah, it was great, though. The lectures were fantastic. I mean, they are every year, but this was... It was a really inspiring and well done day of talks. We had a lot of people who are just out there actually doing things on the ground floor, I guess, so to speak. People like Robert Lancaster, who does Stop Sylvia Brown, and Mark Roberts, who is a 9/11 conspiracy theory debunker. It was just a really great time. And then, of course, there are the parties, which is the reason why I'm still recovering 3 days later.
3 day hangover. Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty impressive.
Ouch.
I did throw a party again. It was broken up by the cops again. Cops in Fort Lauderdale. Cops in Fort Lauderdale.
I remember that one in Vegas. That was fun.
Yeah. It was actually, I thought it'd be smaller because the conference itself was smaller, but. No, it was just as big, just in a smaller space and with more surly cops. So,
hey, Rebecca, so I saw some pictures. You guys are actually at Randy's house, right?
Well, we weren't at Randy's house. We went to the JREF headquarters, which is kind of like Mecca for the non-religious. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic. I highly recommend anybody who's down in Florida stop by. Randy loves to accept visitors. He will show you around the JREF headquarters. It's a great building. And the best part about it, of course, is the library, which is just packed full of everything you could ever want. Like books that are hundreds of years old, like Discovery of Witchcraft. He's got an early edition of that. And then just these, you know, weird little knickknacks everywhere you turn, like fairy fossils and things like that. It's a lot of fun.
So he has them.
Oh. How many people showed up this year?
I think there were maybe 200 because of it being a smaller event and stuff compared to the larger Vegas event, which had, I think, 700 or 800 back in last January.
That's still pretty good. Right.
Although I think it's going to be bigger this year. TAM 6 is, I think.
Yeah, TAM 6 is probably going to be huge judging by... See, a lot of people came to this one as sort of just a tester TAM, I think, because they were a little scared to go to the big one in Vegas, so they thought they'd come to this smaller one. Mm-hmm. And I heard from a lot of people who were just so pleased with how cool everyone was and how much fun stuff there was to do and the quality of all the talks that I heard a lot of people committing to come to Vegas in June for TAM 6. So.
Well, welcome back. Thanks for giving us the report. Let's get on to some news items. This first one was sent to us by a number of our listeners who are eager to spread a little bit of skeptical good news. This is about homeopathy in the UK. The National Health Service there apparently is shutting down a lot of the offerings of homeopathy. A recent survey showed that a large number of the primary care trusts, I guess that's how it's divided up. The health services are divided up in the UK, are no longer offering homeopathic services and referrals. Only 37% still have contracts for homeopathic services. So this is decreasing. That's a very good thing. The scientific community, the medical community in the UK over the last couple of years has really gone on the offensive, trying to win over public support for this idea that homeopathic remedies are no better than placebos. They're pre-scientific. They really don't belong in a modern science-based healthcare service. And this message is getting traction over there and having tangible results. So I really hand it to our country. colleagues over in the UK. They need to keep the pressure on. We need to spread this kind of effect over here across the pond to the United States, although the homeopathy is entrenched in a very different way over here. It is entrenched because it's written into the FDA, so it basically has pre-approval for the homeopathic pharmacopoeia in the Food and Drug Administration. So that would be a different fight that we'd have to fight on this side. But I think that just the fact that they have been so successful over there is very very encouraging to all of these efforts.
Yeah, and it always struck me as being a much bigger issue over there, kind of like how creationism is our big thing, but still infects them. I feel like alternative medicine is their big thing that kind of leaks over here and infects us as well.
And the royal family have been big proponents of homeopathy for a very long time.
Yeah, well, certainly homeopathy is in Europe in general and in the UK for that reason. You know, alternative medicine, you have to which is kind of an artificial category, you have to say what parts of it. Chiropractic is definitely an American phenomenon, for example. So I've always thought that of all of the pseudoscientific healthcare modalities, that homeopathy was the most vulnerable to this kind of coordinated pressure, you know, or attack from scientific medicine. That it's like the low-hanging fruit, that if we really wanted to get rid of one piece of this, that would be it. So this, I think, to some degree confirms that, although they're not going to go down without a fight. And this, I think, is going to be a long-term struggle. But I do like the fact that that scientists and physicians have come to the realization, you know, beyond our small circle of skeptics, that it's okay. You know, it's okay to defend science-based medicine, that you don't need to be embarrassed or you don't need to bow to political correctness, that we can be completely bold in saying that, you know, unscientific treatments are bad for the public, they're bad for medicine, and we should oppose them. So this is a good,
I like the way you subtly worked the name of your latest blog in there, Steve.
Well, you know, the blog is not called Science-Based Medicine by accident. I mean, I chose that term because that's what I think we should be that's the flag I think we should be rallying around. You know, it's just a little bit of an attempt on my part to, you know, reframe the whole topic. This is a conversation that we've been having for years, that the proponents of so-called complementary alternative medicine or integrative medicine have completely won the linguistic battle. They've, you know, in a very Orwellian way, deliberately crafted terminology that accomplishes just the terminology itself accomplishes so much for them. And I think that we shouldn't just buy into it. You know, so the difference is that there's science-based medicine and then there's everything else. That's really what it comes down to. And I think
there's
you have
crap-based
to remember that.
Medicine.
Right, it was crap-based medicine, that's right.
I'm going to start a blog called Crap-Based Medicine.
It's good as good as anything else we've come up with.
Right. That's great. Well, if they've won the linguistic battle, then fuck them. But Steve, I got a quote here. Steve, you were talking about them fighting back, and this is pretty much what it amounts to. Dr. Tim Robinson, GP, provides local homeopathic service in Dorset. He said that patients denied the treatments on the NHS may take risks by consulting non-medical homeopathic practitioners. Like they might get dirty water or something. Oh, my goodness.
That's right. That's the myth, that there are good homeopathic providers and bad homeopathic providers. Yeah, that's always the justification for licensure, et cetera, which then just becomes a false form of legitimacy and then also just a mechanism for controlling competition, but not for really for quality control, because there is no method for quality control when the modality is not based upon science and evidence. You cannot control witchcraft. There's no basis for it whatsoever. It's an oxymoron.
You know, I found a quote by a man called Peter Fisher, and he works at the Royal London Homeopathic Hospital.
Yeah, he runs it, actually.
And I'm happy to see that his name doesn't have like doctor after it or anything. But he said they are particularly, and he's talking about the homeopathic hospitals in general, I think. He said they are particularly well equipped to treat patients whose complex chronic health problems have not been effectively treated by conventional medicine. I think that statement has so many little hidden things in it. The first thing is, you know, the whole idea about, oh, you know, if conventional medicine can't help you, then homeopathic medicine or homeopathic treatments are the way to go. Like, that's one of the things that I read a lot about homeopathic treatments. That, you know, okay, if you don't get what you need over there, come over here, which is kind of like a cure-all, you know?
Yeah, so it's a false dichotomy, and it's very much what the creationists do. Oh, there's all these problems with evolution, so the only other option is, you know, is ID or creationism. It's like, well, even if there were problems, I mean, there are problems, obviously, with modern medicine. We certainly have not cured everything, and there's you know, we could talk for a long time about things that need to be improved, but the faults of scientific or mainstream medicine in no way means that anything else, any other quote-unquote alternative, has legitimacy. You know, so it's a completely illogical statement.
I think that quote that I gave is a deliberately well-crafted and particularly well-placed statement that he said, because he says patients whose complex chronic health problems have not been effectively treated by conventional medicine. And, you know, that really is, if you think about that statement, complex chronic health problems, those are the things where people go to the doctor and they, I'm suffering from fatigue and no doctor can help me. I'm suffering from migraines and no doctor can help me.
Yeah, this is subjective.
You're exactly right, Jay. They know their target. They're targeting the worried well, people who have self-limiting or who have chronic symptoms, but not like urgent or life-threatening diseases, you know, that need real medicine.
Yeah, the real complex ones are the ones they want.
Yeah.
By the way, while all this has been going on, I have registered a blog at crapbasedmedicine.wordpress.com.
You're saying,
are you doing it?
You're saying
you,
the domain's available?
It's right. I just said it. It's crapbasedmedicine.wordpress.com. And I've even written my first post, just so
that's
you know.
That's great.
Excellent.
Sign me up.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm.
Here's a funny quote that I don't know where I got this from. I just wrote it down years ago, and it just struck me as pretty funny. Somebody, it might have been a skeptical email group, as a matter of fact. Somebody said, "It's curious, isn't it, that with low-grade chronic conditions like back pain, seasonal affective disorder, what have you, people are eager to try alternative hocus-pocus, but bring on something virulent, acute, and truly terrifying, then brother, bring on Western medicine. Nothing like your eyeballs leaking blood to put things into perspective, eh?"
Right.
I always liked
that.
So
that happened to me last week when I took some NyQuil. My eyeballs just exploded. There was blood all over the walls. It was awful, but it did stop my sniffling, sneezing, coughing, achy head.
You know what else this Peter Fisher fellow said? From this homeopathic hospital, he said, "I'm confident for various reasons that we will survive." And I think he's correct, because homeopathy is, you know, it might be reduced, it might be beaten back, but it's never going to go away entirely. It will always be lurking. And you know what? I won't be surprised if 10 years from now things change and they bring it back.
Yeah, well, I think history has shown that the best we could do is to marginalize things like this.
Right.
Yeah, maybe eventually they may wither a little bit on the vine, but I think, yeah, we rarely completely eradicate any such things. I mean, there are still phrenologists around, you know. I mean, they never go away entirely.
You know, to quote a brilliant skeptic, I don't remember who said this. I think it was me. I said, in the future, some complete jackass is going to be on a spaceship to Pluto, and he's going to be taking a homeopathic remedy. I mean, it's never going to go away, Evan. Never. As long as humans are alive, there's going to be some type of woo-woo out there that they're going to be explaining things.
And that's why people need to remain diligent.
And hopefully, yeah, there'll always be skeptics there pointing that out. Let's go on to the next news item. This is a bit of creation science news. The young Earth creationists, specifically Ken Ham from the Answers in Genesis propaganda ministry, have created a new peer-reviewed journal, the Answers Research Journal, or the ARJ. And they say that they've created this in order to create a peer-reviewed journal in which creation scientists can publish their original research, since they're being so academically oppressed and they can't get their research published in real scientific journals.
What is a creationist peer exactly? Is that like a chimp?
God. God reviews the journal.
Maybe a bonobo?
No, they don't consider chimps their peers. I mean, that would be too evolutionary.
It's God.
Oh, right. Good point. How ironic.
Yeah, right. So this brings up a lot of issues. You know, what does it mean to be peer reviewed by other morons? You know, nothing. And this is a very common trend that we've seen in the last 10 or so years, that with the proliferation of many alternative views of science, whether it's based upon a certain political ideology or in this case a religious ideology, people have decided that they could just manufacture their own trappings and institutions of science. And if they can't, you know, make headway in the halls of legitimate science, they'll just make their own. They'll make their own discovery institute, you know, they'll make their own journals, they'll make their own degrees. You know, the creationists are trying to get a degree in creation science and the Texas curriculum. They'll just manufacture all the trappings of science. This is a very, very damaging because it dilutes out the credibility of these institutions, and it also confuses the public. I mean, it no longer really means anything if you have a bunch of letters after your name. They could mean absolutely nothing, or to have an institute. It's especially insidious with the web because you can create the appearance of a really mainstream, legitimate institution just by having a slick website. You know, I mean, the Discovery Institute's website is very well done, and they can very quickly and cheaply create the appearance of legitimacy more so than with, say, a brick and mortar, you know, infrastructure. So, it just makes it all the more difficult for the public to navigate here.
Steve, would you consider something like a doctor of chiropractic medicine, would you consider that to be kind of like false advertising in a way? Like,
yeah, I do. I mean, I do think that because, you know, chiropractic medicine, what is that? What is that? I mean, I think, again, there should just be scientific medicine and then everything else. And I think that the term doctor should have a very specific meaning. You know, otherwise, again, it confuses the public as to exactly what that is. I don't think there should be doctors of naturopathic medicine either. So this is similar, and then also, you know, we've been talking about alternative medicine and homeopathy. They've been very good about this too, basically creating their own peer-reviewed journals to publish their own papers. It's also like the, you know, the ESP literature. You know, you have their own, you know, peer-reviewed journals to publish all your ESP research in. It does dilute out the value of being quote-unquote peer-reviewed to the point where, in and of itself, it means nothing. You know, you really have to take each journal on its own credibility and history. The one thing that I find interesting about this is that the intelligent design and proponents and the creationists have been whining endlessly about their academic oppression, that they can't get their research published. Okay, here you go. You got your own peer-reviewed journal. Publish away. Bring it. Let's see what you have. I don't think that we're going to start seeing really high quality, you know, original creation research published in this journal. It's probably going to be just like the Discovery Institute that doesn't actually do any ID research. It's just a propaganda mechanism. They're just going to be publishing opinion pieces in this journal. That's what I predict. Let's move on to the next news item. This was also sent to us by a number of our listeners. This next piece is about facilitated communication in the courtroom. Now, facilitated communication is something that emerged in the 1980s. It is the idea that individuals or certain individuals who are cognitively impaired, who may be, for example, you know, profoundly developmentally delayed and cannot speak, that perhaps they have more mental ability than is apparent, and if they were helped to communicate, that we may tap into an unseen mental world or their unseen cognitive ability. This was a very, of course, hopeful hypothesis. A lot of people got sucked into this very, very quickly. The notion that you know, a child who was previously just, you know, sitting and staring off into space actually had a very active mental life, you know, for both for parents and for practitioners, was a very seductive notion. And then when students, you know, or when these children with the help of a facilitator started saying things like "I love you, mommy," and writing poetry, I mean, the you know, the emotions ran roughshod over science and skepticism, and there weren't enough people saying, "Is this real? I mean, are these kids really communicating?" Of course, when those questions were asked and when the studies were done, you know, it was shown that, no, they're not communicating. So what this is again, like dowsing, what we call the ideomotor effect. You have a facilitator holding the hand of an impaired child, and then they will, you know, help them, you know, either point to letters on a board or type letters on a typewriter. And the facilitator is just supposed to be aiding them because they don't have the motor strength or control to do it on their own. And, you know, as it turns out, the facilitator was the one doing the communication. They were subconsciously controlling where the child was pointed, and this was clearly
many of you may have seen that on Law and Order. That's mm-hmm. how I learned about it.
Law and Order. Nova did a special on it. You know, it's been clearly shown that it doesn't work. That you're just communicating only what the facilitator knows, not what the child does. So The darkest manifestation of this entire episode was the use of facilitated communication in order for profoundly cognitively impaired individuals to give, apparently, to give testimony in courtroom. And this almost always took the form of, for example, a parent facilitating their child in giving testimony against their estranged ex-spouse. You know, all a little bit too convenient. Or overzealous healthcare, you know, workers, giving facilitating testimony against the caregivers or the parents of the child. So, can you imagine? You know, imagine being a parent of a mentally impaired child, and then some incompetent provider not only has tricked themselves into thinking that they're communicating with your child, but that communication accuses you of like raping and abusing them. And then can you imagine a judge allowing that testimony in a courtroom? And that's basically what happened in a court case against a West Bloomfield couple who they have a severely autistic daughter. And the Bloomfield Hills District Judge Mark Barron allowed this 14-year-old girl's testimony in court through the aid of a facilitator.
He wasn't just evaluating the potential testimony of this girl to determine whether it should be officially be allowed.
Yeah, so that's correct. I mean, the defending attorneys wanted to exclude the testimony just a priori, just say this is not real testimony, so you have to exclude it. I think that probably, from a scientific or factual basis, that would have been the better decision. Now, these kind of legal decisions could always be decided on two broad types of basis, either on the facts or on the legality. And I don't, none of us are lawyers or understand legal issues enough to know what the details were in this case. It's possible, Bob, as you say, that the judge was making the decision more for legal reasons and wanted to defer to another process, deciding about the value of this testimony. So right. I think that the first layer of deciding whether or not it was admissible, he decided that it was admissible, but he could still decide that the testimony needs to be considered in the context of facilitated communication.
Here's one thing I don't get. It's being claimed that this poor girl was raped many times since she was 6 years old. How about a rape test or at least a virginity test? Wouldn't that just close this case?
Yeah, the press is not giving those details. So we're not privy to those details. More will probably develop over time. But
if they're even having this court case.
Sometimes these cases get truly bizarre. When you really have an overzealous caseworker that, not only could they ask leading questions of children, they may explain away the absence of evidence, in a way that truly gets bizarre. And in this case, using facilitated communication is just like admitting spectral evidence. I mean, it really just can turn anything into a witch hunt. So I do think that probably justice would be better served if facilitated communication were found to be inadmissible completely, just de facto, just like lie detectors are inadmissible in court.
No mention in this article of precedent for this ever happening before.
There are people sitting in jail under the testimony of facilitated communication.
That's outrageous.
Yeah, it's outrageous.
Absolutely
outrageous.
It's hard to believe that no one would just do something about that.
Facilitated communication scientifically has been dead since the early 1990s, but it still lingers. Again, this is what we talked about before. These things never go away entirely. They get marginalized, but here we see these tendrils of facilitated communication surviving even in 2008, even to the point of making it into a courtroom. It's really just ridiculous.
A less nefarious example is the polygraph.
Right. That's a more complicated example because the way that's used, but that's inadmissible.
But the polygraph can be beaten. It's been shown time and time again that it is not...
Right. It's not infallible. Right. Right. Doesn't mean it's worthless, but it's not infallible.
It's invoked and used quite often in cases of all kinds.
Yeah, I don't think... From what I heard, and I do not know this authoritatively, that it's not admissible in court.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. But like you said, is that just a myth? I don't think so.
Well, let's go on to the next news item. This one is about ABC's new drama that they're planning to air actually tomorrow Thursday, January 31st. This is a new drama called Eli Stone. The first episode features a lawyer who is suing for a parent who believes that her son's autism was caused by mercury in vaccines. Now, the ABC has gotten a lot of heat about this because they take the tact of the lawyer who's the good guy is defending or is suing for this autistic child and her parent against the evil pharmaceutical companies who are trying to hide the fact that their vaccines and the mercury in their vaccines cause their autism. So they're really coming down pretty hard on the wrong side scientifically, of this debate. Now, the American Academy of Pediatrics, incensed by this, wrote an open letter to ABC asking them to pull the show, or short of that, to air a disclaimer, explaining to the audience that, the scientific evidence shows there's no connection between vaccines and autism. Apparently, the last I heard, that ABC is planning on doing that. They're going to air the show, but they are going to include the disclaimer.
I don't think the disclaimer is going to be that strong. I think it's pretty much, go to the CDC's website to read about this. I don't think they explicitly say that, unfortunately.
So, I mean, I do think that ABC completely dropped the ball in this case. I mean, this is it's a drama, but, the lines between drama and information in modern television have been utterly obliterated and blurred. We have docudramas and infomercials and, dramas where the subject matters have been quote-unquote ripped from the headlines. Reality TV, we have fake reality TV. I mean, it really is difficult to separate, the lines of what's fiction, what's creativity and artistic, and what is reality.
What reality TV is fake?
Well, there are some reality shows that have components of them which are staged, for example.
I'm kidding, man.
It's like wrestling.
Wrestling's
not real. Come on.
Professional. And Steve, there is one important point. Spoiler alert. In this episode, the woman does win, and she wins like $5.2 million or something. So that's what happens at the end.
Yeah.
She wins.
Yeah, right. The writers, they said we did our research and we think this is reasonable. So they're just wrong. They just completely got this one wrong. David Kirby is a journalist who has been promoting the notion that vaccines are linked to autism. He's just a terrible journalist, and who has gone more and more kooky as the evidence comes in against any link between autism and vaccines. His arguments have got more and more and more ridiculous. So he wrote this absurd opinion piece in the Huffington Post about this, saying that the American Academy of Pediatrics is trying to stifle ABC's creativity and accusing them of censorship, and also said that the American public is smart enough to know that a drama isn't real. I mean,
not quite.
He doesn't. I don't think even he believes that. I mean, that's ridiculous. The fact is, you dramatize a debate and you come down hard on one side of the debate. People are not going to. They're just going to remember. Oh, there's a link between autism and vaccines. They're not going to remember what was real and what wasn't real, or that this was – the disclaimer is also not going to really have much of an effect.
Right.
This is just poisoning the public culture, the popular culture, with this fear, this notion that there's some link between autism and vaccines. People aren't really going to remember most of the details. This is, this is right. What the evidence clearly shows. And it's just absurd to think that this is not going to have a negative effect. And, and ABC, I think, is being incredibly irresponsible in showing this.
Yeah, you got these people that watch the Oprah episode. Now they watch this, and they think, oh, it's pretty clear, isn't it?
I'm hearing this everywhere,
Right, right. It's like where there's smoke, there's fire, This is just more smoke.
It's embarrassing. Got something on the polygraph, Steve. So the website is trutherlie.com. It was the first one that came up in the Google search. Is a polygraph admissible in court? Answer, yes, if ruled on by the judge. Admissible in some federal circuits and in some states. Evidence is admissible where the parties have agreed to their admissibility before the examination is given under terms of a stipulation. And it goes on and on.
It's tough to get in, but you can get it in.
It cites past court cases where it's been used and statutes and other things. So this looks pretty on top of it.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks,
Christine.
Well done, Evan.
But one more news item. Bob, you sent me this one about Arabian brain power.
Yeah. Interesting story. in Scientific American this month, February's, called Arabian Brain Power. King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia is building a university that he hopes will once again make the Middle East a leader in science and technology. It's called King Abdullah University of Science and Technology. The acronym is KAUST. I think it's pronounced KAUST, K-A-U-S-T, which is certainly appropriate since it will cost the king about $10 billion to see this thing through, but which he's personally endowing, I think, from his own money, or I don't know.
Pocket change.
The article I read said it was a personal, he's personally giving this money. Yeah, right.
So, Bob, he's well endowed, Bob?
Yeah, right. The endowment given by the king, this endowment's on par with world-class universities like MIT, which is one of the 10 largest university endowments. Some of the really intriguing things about this that interested me was that women and men will be allowed to study side by side. Can you imagine that? Women will be allowed to drive. I mean, in Saudi Arabia, this is a big thing. Now, this autonomy is not unprecedented in Saudi Arabia. For people like, if you're a foreign oil worker, they will not force women to strictly follow all their laws. So they will be able to do these things. So there is some precedence for this type of relaxing of rules. Also, religious police, according to this article, will be barred from the premises. The graduate level university will be independent from Saudi Arabia's government. Now, the interim head of this proposed university, I believe his name is pronounced Al Kowaiter. He said that it will not experience the interference a typical government-run university may. And to further ensure a successful start, King Abdullah is equipping the labs with state-of-the-art equipment and is awarding generous grants to scientists totaling $1 billion over 10 years. He wants to make sure that these scientists that are going to be hired are not, spending half their time just running around trying to find money, at least for, the first 10 years. In conjunction with that, for the first 10 years, full scholarships will be granted to all graduate students and juniors and seniors.
Wow.
I know. It's interesting. Another aspect that I found compelling was the way the research will be organized. Instead of organizing it around departments with like a single discipline, which is very common in most universities, KAUST is going to be using interdisciplinary centers devoted to specific challenges, like, say, energy research, where you've got all these experts in various fields coming together to try to solve these problems. So this seems to have it seems to me that this has got a lot of potential, and I think it's a really good sign. The king wants to transform the kingdom from one based on oil to a more knowledge-based society. And I'll end with a final quote here from Frank Press, which is President Emeritus of the National Academy of Sciences. He said, "This could be a nation-changing enterprise."
I mean, I agree with that. I mean, optimistically, you bring education, and especially at least high-level, cutting-edge education to this part of the world, and with this much funding, then I think that can only have a positive effect, in terms of, moderating that society and that culture, Well, let's do a few emails. We have actually two emails that we got within a few days, both about milk. So I thought we'd handle both of them together. The first one comes from Jordan H. from Massachusetts.
That was a really good introduction. Two emails about milk. Let's go. Woohoo! Skeptic team activate. Sorry.
Wait, let me get my seatbelt on.
Hey, don't denigrate milk. That's very important.
No, it does get body good, I've heard.
Yeah. All right, here's the first one. Hey, Steve and the gang. I'm worried about a friend who's drank copious amounts of organic Kool-Aid, so to speak. He gets raw, unpasteurized milk from a local farm and claims it's actually healthier than pasteurized milk because it contains beneficial bacteria that get killed off in the pasteurization process. Of course, it also might contain some not-so-nice bacteria like E. coli, for instance. This isn't my area of expertise, so I was wondering if you guys could give some more information on the health effects of drinking raw milk. What can I tell my friend that would get him to quit his habit? Thanks for the always excellent podcast, Jordan.
Well, Jordan, tell your friend that chocolate milk comes from brown cows. Isn't that right, Rebecca?
I think that's correct, Jay.
Okay.
Okay, next email.
Yeah, this is, you know, this is always interesting. I do think that there is just this psychological fascination that people have with the elixir of life. You know, they just think that if they just drink the magic elixir, they will be healthy and right. they'll live longer, and it has all these magical properties. There's just something very compelling about the notion.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Got my Nani juice right here.
It's a nice thought.
Yeah, you know, it's the all-natural thing, Steve.
It's not going to you know, unless there's nanites in there, it's just not going to happen.
God. Yeah, Bob wants the nano-infused milk. But so pasteurization, just very quickly, most people probably know this, but it just is using heat to kill bacteria in milk. And it also, in the process, you know, they do also do other things to ensure, you know, the purity of milk, and they do regulate like fat content and things like that. But the most significant thing is just using heat to kill bacteria. Now, the claims that are made by the raw milk advocates are that raw milk is more healthy because the pasteurization process destroys nutrients. That's not true. There's no significant effect on the nutrients. That it destroys enzymes that are helpful or necessary. It does destroy some enzymes, but not others. And the ones that it does are bovine enzymes that we don't really need. We have our own enzymes to digest the milk and absorb the calcium and do what we need. So there's a minimal effect on that, and there's no apparent negative health effect on humans from that. They claim that it kills the beneficial bacteria, and that is true, but again, we don't really need that beneficial bacteria. It doesn't really have any beneficial health effects for us that anyone has demonstrated. Some of them may help ferment the milk and making cheese and yogurt and stuff, but that's irrelevant because we put in the bacteria that we want when we process milk into other products, into dairy products. So, and it's actually better that we can control exactly what bacteria are put in there for the fermenting process. So there really isn't anything beneficial that's taken out or destroyed or removed by the pasteurization process. There's zero evidence that there's anything healthy about raw milk versus pasteurized milk. In fact, processed milk has vitamin D put into it, which is a very helpful fortification. So if anything, it is more healthy or more nutritious. And you know, some people, the raw milk advocates, may claim that it's more creamy and more delicious. That's just because there's more fat in there, because that fat is not regulated. If you, you know, decrease the amount of fat in milk, you know, like reduced fat milk or skim milk, yeah, it's less creamy because there's less fat in there.
Have you guys ever tasted unpasteurized milk?
Nope. I have.
Yes.
I did once by accident.
It's quite different.
Well, you know, it was interesting. I was at this was my college days, and we were out late at a diner. And in this neighborhood in town, there are a lot of, you know, Polish immigrants and stuff that immigrated to this area. So this diner caters to, you know, the older generation from Poland, and they didn't have pasteurized milk. So that's what they served in this restaurant. And I don't know if it was creamier. It was like something was, you definitely taste it and something was wrong with it, right? Not like it was spoiled, but it was almost like they added something to it. It was like, what is in this milk that I couldn't detect? And only after the fact, I realized exactly what I was drinking.
Right.
So. I never noticed the difference. I used to drink it quite a bit because I grew up in the Garden State, where there are actually farms. And so, yeah, like friends who had cows and stuff would usually just have the raw milk that they would drink. So I never noticed the difference, though. And I never got sick from it. But also, I never, you know, magically cured any diseases with it. So take that for what it is.
Steve, some of the people that are into raw milk, they think that it actually boosts the immune system and all that hubbub.
Yeah.
As well.
Well, boosting the immune system is nonsense. There's no such thing as boosting the immune system. That's just what people say because they can say it, because it's not regulated.
Sounds fancy.
The immune system is a highly balanced, delicately regulated, complex system within the body. And it's a series of trade-offs. Inflammation helps us fight off infections, invading organisms, but it also damages our own tissue. So boosting the immune system, what does that mean? Are you making it more efficient, more targeted? You know, that would require, you know, evolution. You know, that would require a tinkering with this really complex system to make it actually function better. What they're usually talking about when they say boost the immune system, they're just meaning increasing the amount of activity. But that's just as likely to be a bad thing as a good thing. You're taking this system and just pushing it in one direction.
Right.
Increased immune activity could mean increased inflammation. And there's lots of reasons to think that inflammation is bad. You know, chronic inflammation is a bad thing. So any, you know, natural product that claims to boost the immune system either does nothing, or if it actually does what they say it does, it's probably more likely to be a bad thing than a good thing. There's no product out there, there's no supplement or nutrient or whatever that actually makes your immune system more efficient at doing what it does.
So instead of boosting your immune system, they should be saying, throw your immune system out of whack.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's just, yeah. just as meaningful, if not more meaningful, to say, throw your immune system out of whack. Or more specifically, to say, cause chronic inflammation. You know, which is, you know, if you said it that way, though, nobody would think that that's a good thing.
Scientific terms are very dangerous in the hands of people who don't know how to use them.
So Steve Jordan mentioned in his email that like it's possible that E. coli could be in the raw milk. And if anyone has ever been to a dairy farm, they would know that cow poop is everywhere on a dairy farm. It's so mm-hmm. bad that they have to literally bathe the cow's feet in antibacterial wash to help them, you know, whack back like hoof rot and different other situations that come up, and it's bad. So, you know, there is poop everywhere, and it's all over the cows.
Yeah, and so, and cows lay down, and their udders, you know, go right into the filth.
Yeah, it's yeah. utterly disgusting, if you ask me.
Yeah, there are definitely risks. There are risks to drinking raw milk. They could be the risk of contamination is much higher, obviously, than with pasteurized milk.
Yeah, so my point being, you want it boiled, you want it purified. You don't want right. you don't want it raw yeah. like that. Maybe one cow, if some guy's got one cow, but you know they have poop pits at most big dairy farms that where there's like a million gallons of poop, no exaggeration.
Do you guys see that movie Fast Food Nation? I don't want to get on a total tangent.
Yeah,
that
no.
reminds me, Jay, of that one line the guy said: "There's always been shit in the meat."
Yeah, right.
Because it's everywhere, you know?
Yeah. It's true. It's like the line in The Simpsons when Apu says, "Try this jerky. It's mostly rectum free."
Mostly rectum, mostly. One more milk related email. This one comes from Mika Wheeler from Colorado, United States. And they write, "Hi all, I've noticed something odd. A few years back, I went through a phase where I almost exclusively bought organic foodstuffs. Having gotten over that with a little help from my bank statements, I have continued to buy organic milk because it seems to me that it lasts longer before spoiling than regular milk. I mentioned this to my family and friends, and after having tried it, they generally agreed with me. It seems that you can count on it lasting about a week longer. Is there any truth to this, or are we all suffering from an observational bias? And if it is true, why? I'd hate to think that I spread BS even unknowingly. Help me, SGU. You're my only hope."
Nice.
That's awesome.
Princess Leia.
Right, for our geek-impaired listeners, that was Princess Leia. So, first, it's actually interesting to note what is organic milk. The term organic, and we don't really have time this week to get into the whole organic thing. It's very complicated, and I'm probably going to try to get a guest on who can talk about it more definitively before we really sink our teeth into this topic. But just focusing on organic milk for a moment, the USDA certified organic, that always has to do with the process by which things are made or grown, not by any tests that are done on the final product, right? So organic is only about the process by which the produce or whatever is made. With regard to milk, there are four criteria for being certified as organic. First, cows that create organic milk cannot be treated with hormones, such as bovine growth hormone, which is often given to increase milk production. No antibiotics can be used, or if cows have to be given antibiotics, they need to be taken out of the pen where the cows are milked for 12 months. Organic cow feed must be grown without pesticides. Organic cows must have access to pasture. They must be given grazing time. That's it. If you fill those criteria, then you're organic. Makes no claims about the milk itself. Why these things? Well, proponents of organic milk say that, you know, you're better off not having hormones in the milk. However, getting a little bit of hormone like IGF-1 or BGH in the milk, you know, has no health effect because those hormones are proteins that just get eaten up in your gut. They get digested. There's no evidence that it actually affects the levels of these hormones in your blood or that there's any health effects from them whatsoever. With antibiotics, the thing about that is that in conventional, you know, non-organic herds, if any cows are given antibiotics, then they have to be tested and shown to be antibiotic-free, and tanks of milk are routinely tested to ensure that they're antibiotic-free also. So whether or not antibiotics are used, processes are in place to keep any antibiotics out of the milk itself. In terms of the pesticides in the feed, it is true that there will be a little bit of trace pesticides in non-organic milk and not in organic milk if you compare them, but the levels are really trace and they are far below established tolerance levels. And then the grazing time, the interesting thing about that is, first of all, there's no evidence that cows that graze in fields and eat grass produce better or more nutritious milk than cows that are fed on feed, although it does depend on what kind of feed. If you give high-quality feed, then there's really no advantage to grass. And the other interesting thing is that the amount of grazing time really isn't regulated that much. They just have to have some access to grazing time. So that's kind of a very loose criterion in any case. But the real question is organic milk better than non-organic milk? And there's essentially zero evidence for that. There's no evidence of any health benefits for organic milk. So it's probably not worth the extra money. On average, organic milk costs twice as much as regular milk. You're probably better off spending that money on other things.
Well, Steve, I'm not 100% sure I agree with you.
Uh-huh.
One, you know, if you think about it, because there's less chemical, less pesticides, you know, there's less crap being put back into the environment. I mean, pesticides are pretty nasty things, and, you know, that's another thing we could talk about someday. About I believe in a lot of the organic movement because of the fact that they use less chemical and everything, which I think is good.
Well, Jake, let me just stop right there for a second. You're getting off on the very tangent I wanted to avoid tonight because this is such a huge topic. I will just say that I was restricting myself specifically to the health claims made for organic milk. One component of the organic movement is that it's better for the environment, whether or not the end product is healthier for human consumption. That's a completely separate question that needs to be distinguished from any health claims made for the end product. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I think we do need to talk about it. I mean, I actually have a lot that I'd like to say, but we'll save that for when we get someone on that we could really flesh it out with.
Will the milk last longer, a week longer?
I could not find any information on that one way or the other, but I don't see any theoretical reason why it should last longer. Actually, interestingly, raw milk may have a little bit longer shelf life because of some of the enzymes and stuff that are left in there. The next email comes from Jim Chatham. And Rebecca, actually, you blogged about this email, so why don't you read this one for us?
This is one of my favorite emails ever, okay, first of all. He says, after Heath Ledger died, I thought I'd check to see if Nikki, psychic to the stars, had predicted his death. I checked her website, and amazingly, she had. Given that none of her earlier predictions ever mentioned Heath, and that there was nothing particularly adverse in his background that would suggest an early death, this seemed to be a major hit by a psychic. And if you guys recall, we talked about Nikki during our first episode of the year.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
He goes on to say, however, I recently gave a talk at one of my neighborhood clubs about why people believe weird things. I thought it would be fun to end with a reading of some psychic predictions for 2008. So in my research, I copied Nikki's predictions to a file. This was the day before he died. Guess what? No Heath Ledger. Looks like she post-dicted his death. She also added Barack Obama's name to the Death Watch Health Watch list. So is this a case where she just forgot to put Ledger's name down and his death happened to remind her to update her website? I think not, because she also deleted her prediction that Angelina Jolie would be nominated for an Oscar after the Oscar nominations came out. Details can be found on my blog, a link to which we will include on the notes page. Thanks for all your great work, The Skeptic Jim. Thank you so much, Jim. That's like one of the awesomest emails I've gotten in a while. And
that's good work, boys.
Yeah.
That's definitely really good.
I was. It's funny because I got this right before I did a podcasting seminar at TAM 5.5, and we were talking during the seminar about how to increase hits to your blog and how to get some attention amongst all the skeptic blogs out there. And I use this as an example of how to get off your butt and do something cool like that, and you just send it out to other skeptics, mm-hmm. and they will promote it for you like we are doing right now. So well done, skeptic.
Yeah, well done. Although it does seem like he got a little bit lucky here because he just was giving a lecture, so he happened to have the file saved. But he followed through on it really well, and that was great.
Well, and it's not just luck, just so you know, there are a couple of people mentioned this on the when I posted on the blogs. There are resources on the internet for backtracking, like the Wayback Machine. I think there are other archives and caches you can find.
I checked the Wayback Machine for Psychic Nikki's website. Now, they say it takes about 6 months sometimes for the archives to be made available. The only one, the last one that was available on that was from July, and there were no predictions for 2008 yet there. So her website from, say, November or December that would have the predictions are not yet on the Wayback Machine.
Right, although you could maybe find something more immediately on Google Cache, because they cache websites very quickly like that. But, so, yeah, he did, it was certainly fortuitous that he had that information on him, so well done.
But the thing that's left to be said is, what a scumbag he is.
What do you expect?
You know, like, are you kidding me? Like, I wish that something would come of this, but of course, you know, nothing would. But, you know, I'm not surprised, but it's just so disappointing and so, like, are you kidding? When somebody blatantly finds a cheat like this, she needs a big smack.
Yeah, and the thing is, if you look at... I mean, we went over some of Nikki's predictions, and they were so off the wall and ridiculous that honestly, anybody who actually takes her seriously is too far gone for us to reach at this point. But, you know, maybe there's a chance by promoting things like this, we get her one less mention in People magazine or Us Weekly or wherever she's getting press. Right.
What's but part of the job, the self-appointed job of the skeptical movement, is to keep people like this honest by doing things like copying their websites before, so they can't, you know, retrodict when things happen. You
would think that if she really cared about it, she wouldn't be putting up these kind of prediction, these kind of specific predictions in the first place. She
probably doesn't know that, you know, the internet is archived. You know, and things that she could just change history by altering her website.
Wow.
Well, maybe if we promote this enough, she'll be about to know.
Yeah.
Very bad way.
Yeah, I have no idea what the probability is of this getting back to her.
If you look at her Death Watch and Health Watch section where Heath Ledger's name is, what's funny about it is you look through the list and it's either presidential candidates or really old actors.
Mm-hmm.
Or musicians, right? So having his name in there just seems like it sticks out like a sore thumb to me. Like, there's a young guy, a 28-year-old on the list. Another thing that is, as a side note, she has Alex Trebek on there. Whenever I hear his name, I laugh because...
Because of the Saturday Night Live skit?
Because of the SNL skit. Yeah.
Some of the best stuff.
Fascinating.
Thanks for sharing, Jay.
Shut up, Rebecca.
Let's do a quick name that logical fallacy.
I mean, who doesn't know that bit? It's awesome.
It is funny.
It's a good one. This one actually comes from the boards. This one comes from our forum poster, Calvin, under the heading of Name That Logical Fallacy, because he wanted us to comment on this. He says, why is it that when a bunch of guys go meandering through the wilderness looking for a new species that we have no reason at all to believe exist, it is considered a valid, worthwhile, and commendable scientific pursuit? But when a bunch of guys go out into the wilderness looking for an animal whose physical characteristics are well known, which has hundreds of reported sightings, traces, possible hair samples, photographs, film, and allegedly some DNA collected, it is considered to be the worthless, pseudoscientific waste of time that could only be taken seriously by idiots and gullible kooks.
Well, how about the inconsistency fallacy, the bunch of guys? It's not equal. The first bunch of guys are probably PhDs. The second bunch of guys looking for a Bigfoot is probably just a bunch of guys. So that's inconsistent. I think it might fall into the inconsistency logical fallacy.
I think you're hitting upon something that's important, but I don't think that is an inconsistent use of logic or criteria. I think what you're getting at is that this is a false analogy. I think that's the core logical fallacy here. So he's drawing an analogy here, but actually these two situations are not analogous. You know, but by the details that he's choosing to give us, he's sort of biasing it. This is an incredibly biased analogy by the details that are chosen here. What you're bringing up, Bob, is a detail that was deliberately whitewashed, that we're probably dealing on the one hand with people who are scientifically trained, and on the other hand, with people who probably are not scientifically trained. But that's actually not the biggest disanalogy here.
How about unstated major premise fallacy? All his evidence here, sightings, possible hair samples, allegedly some DNA, it's kind of saying that this is all compelling stuff. Mm-hmm. And it isn't. I mean, it's he's not directly saying it, but he wants you to believe that this is compelling evidence when none of it is compelling.
That's true. I agree with that. Now, getting back to the disanalogy, the first case he's describing, you know, I assume he's referring to naturalists who are going into the wilderness to discover new species. What he says here is that look for new species that we have no reason at all to believe exist. That is actually a false premise. We have a very good reason to believe that there are undiscovered species when we go into previously unexplored territory. And in fact, every time we do that, we find new species. So we have a really good reason to think that we're going to find new species. They're not looking for any specific species, but that's okay. This is observational science. This is let's go and see what's there. That's perfectly legitimate scientific endeavor. The second bit, of course, he's talking about Bigfoot, right? That we didn't say that yet. That's what he's getting at, is people looking for Bigfoot, is they have a specific hypothesis. Now, they're hypothesis testing. They're not doing observational science necessarily. They're actually going out because they say they have a specific reason to think that a specific species exists in a specific location. That's very different than saying, let's just go and see what we find.
And now, Randy speaks.
Randy, can you tell us about the new TV series that Uri Geller has been promoting?
Yes, and that he has been actually signed to do. I understand the contracts are worth $1.6 million, which is a hefty sum, even for Mr. Geller. He did the one in the United States on NBC, which didn't cause too much excitement, to say the least. That was called Phenomenon, as you may know. He did it with Chris Angel, and Chris gave Geller a really hard time. But nonetheless, Geller really didn't do anything of any note in it. He just sat there as an advisor on the program and kept repeating that his mind was just blown. His mind apparently blows very easily. However, he had done one in Israel, first of all. It was called Successor, I believe, where he was looking for his successor. I don't think that would be too hard to find. The program in Israel resulted in YouTube running all kinds of exposures, much with my encouragement, I must say, of how Geller did his tricks. And he was caught doing one of the major tricks there, moving the compass needle. He was caught barehanded, so to speak. You could see him plugging the magnet onto his thumb, which is apparently the way that he does the trick with the compass moving. He was left without any routine. He was sort of left naked there. But nonetheless, TV producers from Cyprus and from Germany, and now we find out from Australia and the United States, all over the place, and Hungary as well, have snapped him up on this sort of thing, and he's doing these series in all these different countries. Well, he's just finished doing the second one of the series in Germany. The first one was sort of ho-hum. The second one was ho-hummer. A scandal erupted all of a sudden. Der Stern, which is one of the major publications, print publications in Germany, just yesterday ran a big expose on the fact that the mentalists who had signed the contracts to appear on this new program, Der Stern came right down on Geller, because it turned out that the contracts that the mentalists signed had in them a couple of phrases which they could hardly understand, and I think we can't either. One of them was that if the person who signed the contract won the 100,000 euros, which is about $150,000 or so, that if they won the prize, they wouldn't accept it. Now, that was the advertising gimmick on the thing, was the leading mentalist will win 100,000 euros. But then in the contract, it said that the winner would not accept it. He had to agree not to accept it. The other thing, it was even more egregious in my estimation, was that the viewers were encouraged to phone in their votes for the mentalists. And each phone call cost them the equivalent of American 75 cents, actually 50 euro cents. But that money, they were just throwing down the drain. The votes were not counted. The votes were put aside. Nobody paid any attention to them. They just accepted the money. The decision about the best mentalist would be made by a committee. Now, this is a scandal, a major scandal, that Stern, of course, you got to understand that Stern also ran the thing on the Hitler diaries a few years back, and they're still smarting from that. That turned out to be a hoax that they fell for. So they're not falling for for anything else. They're thinking things out rather carefully, I would say. But nonetheless, the program did go on this last Tuesday night to not much acclaim again. Lots of viewers. Oh, lots of viewers. Big ratings. 4 million people in Germany tuned into it, I'm told. Now, that's very big in Germany. But I think it's very much like the one in Israel. It got top rankings as well among the most tuned into programs. The reason is that people want to see a train wreck. And they saw Geller heading for a train wreck, and they saw the train wreck right there on TV. So they tuned in. They didn't tune in because it was entertaining, or because they were amazed by it, or because they thought that it was the real thing. They were watching a train wreck. So that's the latest Geller story, except for one crowning fact. He did an interview just recently for Magische Welt, I think it is, Magic World. It's a magic publication in Germany, anyway. And he said in so many words, "I no longer claim that I'm psychic. I'm a magician, and I just want to do a good show." Now, that's astonishing. He has backed down all the way. He is no longer a psychic, he says. Now, whether that means he's no longer a psychic or he's no longer claiming to be a psychic, well, that's another matter altogether.
Is that the first time, to your knowledge, he's ever admitted that publicly?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. Because for 35-plus years now, he has been saying such phrases that, "I am not a magician. I don't know how to do magic tricks. I have never done magic tricks. I do not do magic tricks. I am a genuine psychic. I do it with the power of the mind," etc., etc. He has been making those statements. We've got almost 100 accumulated now in a nice folder here right on my computer desktop here, where he has said this sort of thing in print and in person, on TV and in radio shows repeatedly. So he has been lying to people for more than 35 years. And I say lying, not like a magician lies. A magician doesn't lie. A magician says, "I'm going to show you a trick." And he fools you, he or she fools you with the trick. But that's done for purposes of entertainment. It's not done for purposes of confounding you or confusing you or misleading you, getting you to the wrong conclusion at all. You say in advance, "This is a trick. You're a magician. You're a performer, an entertainer." Now he says he's an entertainer. So what is he trying to do? Is he trying to say that the millions of dollars that some governments and private agencies and private individuals spent over the last 35 years to study the so-called Geller effect, is he saying that that was just a joke? Ha ha ha, fooled you all. That's not going to work, I don't think, for Mr. Geller.
Do you think anything will come from that admission?
I think he's going to have a hard time. He's going to have a hard time explaining it, and I think a lot of people are not going to forgive him. You've got to think of a handful, well, maybe 30 or 40 altogether, academics around the world who lost prestige, certainly academically, and some of them never got another important project in the rest of their lives, and some of them are dead by now. But a lot of these people, the academics, were disgraced by the fact that they fell for the Geller lies. They believed that he was telling them the truth. And governments, such as the American government, for example, and Stanford Research Institute, these people actually believed Geller when he said he was psychic. And now he's telling them, "Ha-ha, I lied to you. Just a joke." It's not a very funny joke.
Well, Randy, thank you for the update.
A pleasure.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 genuine, 1 fictitious, and I challenge my skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week?
Yes. Yep.
You guys have been doing very well. You've been running the table on me quite a bit recently. I don't know if you guys are getting better or if I'm getting sloppy.
So you're going to hit us with a whole bunch of obscure crap. Is that where you're going with this?
You know, I'm trying to figure out how to make it more. I mean, I'll disclose a little bit about my process. I choose items I want to talk about first and foremost, and then I try to make them into interesting science or fiction items. But it's the first criterion is that they have to be interesting news stories that I want to talk about. I want to make it as hard as I can for you guys without making it unfair or without making it too hard for the audience in general. So that's a sweet spot that I was doing okay for a while, but you guys have gotten too good, so I have to readjust. So we'll see how I do this week. All right, you ready?
Yep.
All right, item number one. A new analysis of the homology of multiple endogenous retroviruses among primates suggests that humans may be more closely related to orangutans than chimpanzees. Item number two. Researchers have discovered how to use DNA to guide the creation of three-dimensional nanoparticles. And item number three. A new study shows that all humans with blue eyes share a single common ancestor. I forgot to tell you that the theme this week, if you haven't figured it out, is genetics. Evan, please go first.
Aw, crap. I just had to slip that in. The first one was new analysis of the homology of multiple endogenous?
Endogenous.
Retroviruses. Gee, that's a mouthful. Okay, but closely...
You can call them ERVs.
More closely related to orangutans than chimpanzees. Yeah, it seems very plausible. And then the second one was using DNA... to guide the creation of 3D nanoparticles. A new study shows that all humans with blue eyes share a single common ancestor. A single common ancestor, blue eyes. Why? I wonder why that would be. Something about that is not making sense to me. So I'll say that the single common ancestor with blue eyes, that one's fiction.
Okay. Jay?
I have a question. What does
endogenous.
These are bits of viral code, DNA, that are inactivated and that are embedded into human or vertebrate species DNA.
Okay, I know what they are now. I didn't know what that word meant.
Evolution 101 covered these very nicely.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the researchers have discovered how to use DNA to guide the creation of 3D nanoparticles. That's cool, and that's one of those ones I hope is true. But I don't really remember anything about that. A new study shows that all humans with blue eyes share a single common ancestor. That's definitely plausible. I'm going to say that the first one, the one about that we are more closely related to orangutans than chimpanzees, that one is the fake.
Okay. Bob?
Number three, the blue eyes, single common ancestor. I'm going to buy that one. I'm going to say that is science. Number two, using DNA to guide the creation of 3D nanoparticles. Nanoparticles is kind of a weird way to put it. Nanoparticles? But I think I'm gonna say that's science as well, because I mean that's what DNA does. It's got the code to build ribosome. Using what RNA and ribosomes and things to create the cellular organelles and stuff. I mean, so I could see using DNA to do that. That it's cool, and like Jay said, I hope that's true. So I'm gonna say that's science as well. Number one. I could see how you would use the multiple endogenous retroviruses to show that orangutans are closer to humans than chimpanzees if we have similar ones that have similar viruses that have mutated a similar amount, and say if the chimpanzees had them that were more mutated or something. But I think we would have known that. I mean, I think there's other things telling us that chimpanzees and humans are more closely related than any of the other apes, and I thought it was pretty well conclusively shown that I think orangutans and gorillas were more closely related. So I'm going to say I think you're twisting that somehow. So I'm going to say number one, the retroviruses is fiction.
Okay, Rebecca.
Yeah, I agree, but I'll do it in a speedier way. DNA, I've heard of that being used in the past or at least looking at models of it to help with things like that, nanoparticles. Yeah, that sounds good. All humans with blue eyes sharing a single common ancestor. Am I a freak? Don't all humans have a single common ancestor?
What that means is that there was one person who was the first person ever to have blue eyes, and all people with blue eyes derive their blue eyes from that person.
He didn't say one person. He said a single common ancestor.
Yeah, that common ancestor was a person, right?
Yeah. Well, anyway, I'm going to go with the first one about the orangutans. I don't think that's true.
Okay, so you all agree that researchers have discovered how to use DNA to guide the creation of 3D nanoparticles, and that is science.
Woohoo!
And yeah, you guys are basically right about that. This is not that much of a stretch, although it's very cool, very, very new technique. So they've been able to use DNA to yield 3D crystalline organization of nanoparticles. And they think this could be a way of producing, complex three-dimensional, nanoscale products, particles with dimensions measured in the billionths of a meter. And the ability to generate 3D structures is essential for, you know, manufacturing. This could lead to tons of applications. This is one of those just basic technologies that could theoretically have many, many, many applications. So that is very cool. Let's go to number three. A new study shows that all humans with blue eyes share a single common ancestor. Evan, you're alone in thinking that this one is fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science, and this one is...
Science.
Yeah, this is, as I said, this is the discovery that probably all humans with blue eyes inherited their blue eyes from an original person who had a unique mutation, a genetic mutation making brown eyes blue. At one point in human history, we all had brown
eyes. Sorry, Linda Ronstadt.
Sometime, probably around 6,000 to 10,000 years ago, one individual had a mutation in the OCA2 gene, which altered the amount of melanin in the iris of the eyes, causing it to appear blue. And all blue eyes derive from that. This is based upon, you know, looking at this gene in different people with blue eyes, and they are all very, very similar. So there were probably not different mutations resulting in independently at different times in blue eyes, just a single one event in human history creating blue eyes.
That's cool.
Which means that, number one, a new analysis of the homology of multiple endogenous retroviruses among primates suggests that humans may be more closely related to orangutans than chimpanzees, is indeed fiction. And for the reasons that you guys stated, the evidence does pretty clearly show that humans are more closely related to chimpanzees than any other primate. Although, you know, there was a time when orangs were in the running, where from fossil evidence, you know, we thought that maybe they might be our closest cousins. But the genetic evidence very clearly swung towards the chimpanzees. So, but there was a recent news item involving endogenous retroviruses. Well, this is very interesting. Now, as I described, endogenous retroviruses are bits of retroviral DNA that get stuck in the human genome. What happens is a mutation occurs, so that the virus becomes inactivated. So rather than carrying out its life cycle, where, you know, a retrovirus inserts the DNA into a place in the human chromosome or whatever the species is, whatever the individual is, and then hijacks the machinery of the cells in order to make more copies of itself. But occasionally what happens is that bit of viral DNA has a mutation and that inactivates it. And now it's stuck there in the DNA. And if it happens to be in a germ cell, that will get passed on and gets added to the genome. So these are really, really useful, by the way, in comparing, you know, different species to each other. Because if two different species have the same endogenous retrovirus in their DNA, they had to have gotten that from a common ancestor with that endogenous retrovirus. So it's a really good way to map out genetic relationships, which is why I, you know, made up the bit that I did. But what the new study was showing is that perhaps, though, some of these human endogenous retroviruses may actually have function. Now, the assumption was that they were completely junk DNA. They served no function at all, which makes sense. If it's just this random bit of inactivated viral DNA stuck in our genome, why would it do anything? But it's possible that with this genetic sequence sitting there in our genome for millions of years, that just by chance alone, it may have taken on some function or some process, and now actually functions as a gene in some cases. What they show is that recent work has provided some tantalizing evidence supporting the roles of HERVs in normal physiology and also in disease. They can be seen as bona fide human genes. They may be crucial for healthy pregnancy, for example, and may also be linked to some diseases like multiple sclerosis and even some cancers. Essentially, this means we need to take a closer look at these and not assume that they're not serving any function for good or for ill in the genome.
Steve, quick question. What is the hallmark of the genetic code that clues us in that it's a retrovirus and not just non-retroviral?
Well, if it's wearing platform shoes, Bob, it's a retrovirus.
We compare it to known retroviruses. You know, there are certain sequences that they have, and so we just recognize that, hey, this looks like this other retrovirus. This sequence has homology, is similar to this other retrovirus. So maybe that's what it is.
So there might be other snippets of retroviruses in our code that we just never recognize because we don't know about that retrovirus or it went extinct.
Yeah, although there are some endogenous retroviruses in our genome that do not have any living relatives, you know, that are extinct, that we just recognize them just by the sequences. About 8% of the human genome is made up of these viral bits. 8%, it's a lot. And also, this doesn't imply that they all have function. Some of them probably are, you know, bits of junk DNA in the genome. Well, good job, everyone, except for Evan.
Uh-huh.
All right, well, I still got one of you this week.
Yeah.
I'll have to ratchet up again for next week. Maybe we'll get two of you.
This is natural fluctuation, Steve. Just chill out.
You don't want me to make them harder, Bob?
No, I see no reason.
Okay. Well, Jay, do you have a quote for us to close out the show?
Yeah, I have a cool quote from Max Planck. Max was a German physicist, born 1858, died in 1947, and it was considered to be the founder of quantum theory. Max said, "An experiment is a question which science poses to nature, and a measurement is the recording of nature's answer." Max Planck!
He was awesome. He is one of my heroes.
He and Einstein.
Yeah, Planck's constant. Yeah, if you got a constant of nature named after you,
Einstein wrote back and forth, and they were big.
He started. I mean, he started the whole quantum revolution. I mean, it pretty much started with him. I mean, he pointed the way. And awesome. 1905.
Well, everyone, thank you for joining me again. Always a pleasure.
Rebecca,
you have a little announcement to make.
I do indeed. I'm going to be in New York City on February the 16th. That's a Saturday at 1 p.m. I'm going to be doing a lecture, kind of like what you did, only, you know, cooler, for the New York City skeptics. So I'm not sure of the exact place yet. It will be somewhere in New York, though, and I'll have that information for you guys probably next week.
Okay, yeah, we'll post it up as soon as we get that.
Cool.
Steve, I have a couple of announcements. One, I won't be here next week. I'll be in Sweden, and I'm going to try, I might have a day off at the end of the trip, and I'm going to try to dig up some type of cool local folklore or whatever during that day. I hope I can report something interesting back.
Pseudoscience in Sweden. That is your task, Jay.
The next quick announcement is that when I get back from my trip, I will contact everyone about the website. I'm sorry, I've just been so busy at work, I haven't had a chance. But expect an email from me in about a week and a half to 2 weeks. And that this will be the final run-through. I will email everyone back that emailed me, and we'll figure out who's going to help do what. And I'm really looking forward to it.
You so better. Going to start revolting.
So hang in there, Jay. We'll get back to you. So I'll see everyone next week, except for Jay. Jay, have a good trip to Sweden. We'll talk to you when you get back.
Bye.
Have a good trip,
Jay.
Good
night, everyone. Good night. Nighty
night. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.